Don't worry about that. I'm Mike Fitzpatrick. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is still April 23rd, 1985, and for that I am grateful. Just to kind of set the mood for what I'd like to share with you over the next little while, I've asked Joe to play a recording for us.
What happened, and what we are like now.
For those for those of you that didn't know, that was Bill W. Excuse me. I think I must have talked too much earlier. You know, Bill lived his entire life wanting to just be an AA member. And, you know, I wanted to start my talk about the history, giving Bill the opportunity to just be another voice in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that that's kind of a tribute that we can have in recognition that, you know, there is nobody any more important than anyone else in AA. When you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you have a desire to not drink and you meet that qualification of the third tradition, you're just as much a member of AA as anybody else is. And the only one that can say you're in is you. And I'm grateful for that. But I know that our co-founders had some difficulty with that because of what they did in the lives of all of us. And certainly when Bill would travel, there would be, you know, exhaustive amounts of people that would want to meet him and have him sign a book or, you know, visit with him and talk with him. And I know that that had to be a challenge for Bill. And, you know, and we all hear the things about Bill that, you know, he suffered from depression. And, you know, many alcoholics, you know, suffer. Many people, you know, suffer from depression, whether it's mild depression or really, really drastic depressions. But, you know, Bill was one of those guys who really suffered terribly with depression. Myself, and the reason that, you know, what happened to me as far as being involved in the history, and I don't usually agree to do history talks, and I don't because I always feel like there's somebody else more qualified than me to do that. And until recently, I've declined, and recently I've started saying, well, you know, I can do a little bit as long as I get to kind of share my story with it, because there's a reason that the history is so important to me. And I shared part of that earlier when I gave you my talk, and that was, you know, when I got down to Texas and they had the Midwest Tape Library there, Bill and John and Arbutus, you know, who she was one of the pioneers in Al-Anon. And, you know, she was going to meetings of NAA. Okay? A lot of you don't know what NAA is, but before Al-Anon, her group that she was going to was called Non-Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? It was kind of different, you know. And some of them called themselves the Alcoholics Anonymous Auxiliary. And they had the triple A groups. Okay? So that was while Al-Anon was forming. She was part of that. And then Al-Anon, you know, became Al-Anon in 1951 and took the name. Well, so I had influences from people like that, okay, that were involved in my sobriety early on in my sobriety. My dad's sponsor was a guy named Art, and he was from East Aurora, New York. And Art got sober December 26th of 1946. And, of course, he knew Bill W., and he, as I mentioned earlier, was on stage in Cleveland when the traditions were adopted into Alcoholics Anonymous in the form that we have them now, when they became part of AA. And, you know, he would come over to my house every day, and they would talk AA, and they would work with people, and, you know, I would watch, and I would listen, and I think I learned some things. And I would say, looking back on that particular man, I was so later inspired by him because he had more humility than anyone that I ever met in my life. You know, tremendous humility and tremendous wisdom. And I remember one day I was just sideways over something, you know, and somebody did something and I went to him and I said something and his response to me, I'll never forget it. And this was like the worst thing he ever said, you know. And he says, Mike, just remember there's more horses' asses than there are horses. And it was like, I held this guy in way up here, and I know that we don't do that in AA, that we shouldn't do that. Because I was always told not to place my dependency on people. Don't place your dependency on your sponsor. You know, place your dependency on a God of your understanding. But there are people in our lives that touch us, and sometimes we have a tendency of making these people be bigger than they are. And he was certainly one of those people in my life. And then when I was in Texas, I had John and Bill, and you know, John would speak a lot, and Bill would tape the conferences, so I'd get to go, and they would introduce me to everybody. And I remember meeting this guy, Roy Y. And Roy, at that time, was one of the longest sober members of AA. Roy helped to start AA in Texas, and he started AA in Florida, in Tampa, Florida. And I don't know if he was the first member in Florida, but Roy had to come in around 1940. And, you know, meeting him was, for me, it was really cool because I got to talk to this guy and ask him some questions, just hang out with him. And it wasn't like, you know, now if I had the opportunity, I'd interview him, you know. But then I didn't have that much interest in the history. I was just around it. And that's, you know, kind of what it caught me. And I think because of the history, I was able to get sober when I shared this story this morning of Eddie. You know, that really had an impact with me. After my wife and I got married, we moved to Michigan. She was teaching school. And the agreement was that we would move there. We got married in December, and that we would stay throughout that school year, and then we would move to Arizona when the school year was over. So I decided that it probably was a good idea for me not to go to work. And, you know, it just made sense. So I went to a ton of meetings. You know, I go to meetings all the time. And we were newlyweds, and things were great. And after a meeting one day, this guy said, "Hey, Mike, I want to bring you over to visit a friend of mine." And we go to this lady's house, and they bring me up. It's on this little pond, and it was like a condo. And we go over to her house, and we go upstairs into her home, and we're greeted, and just the sweetest lady. Her name was Ruth, and she made me a cup of tea, and we sat there and visited, and she starts telling me that her husband was AA number 78, okay? And his name was Ernie G. Now, AA number 4 was an Ernie, too, but this was Ernie G. from Toledo. Okay. Anyway, Ruth was telling me about when her and her husband came into AA, and I'm thinking, are you in AA? And she wasn't, but they came together, and they came in Dr. Bob's house. Okay. And so she would start telling me stories of Dr. Bob and Ann, and going to meetings of the Oxford group at T. Henry and Clarice Williams' house in Akron, Ohio. And she made the mistake that day of telling me that I was welcome to come back whenever I wanted. And so on Friday afternoons, I would show up at Ruth's house, and we would just sit and visit. You know, she'd cut me out affirmations and give me things like that, and we would talk. And the reason I share that, and maybe a little bit when I go into some more history on AA, I'll share with you some of the things that she did tell me. But the thing I'm trying to say here is that for some reason, it seemed that I was always either gravitated toward that, or God kept putting these people in my life. So that, you know, it was like one person after another, and it had to do with the early roots of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I end up with this audio library that I shared with you that Bill and Arbutus had down there in Texas, and a lot of archives. I have a tremendous amount of Al-Anon archives as well, and I'm trying to get them all archived and taken care of. But being involved in that has given me tremendous resources for information on AA and Al-Anon. I've had the pleasure of listening to recordings that no one's ever heard. You know, I found one the other day, and it was Sister Ignatia talking to patients. Okay? And what they did is somebody brought a tape recorder in and sat it on a table, and she talked for like 35 minutes. It's not the best quality, but I know it's the only one. So some of those things have just been a real thrill for me. to be involved in, and I'm, you know, anxious about making these things available to people as well. But for history purposes, that stuff, and there were a couple more recordings from Sister Ignatia. She was interviewed on a Cleveland radio program, and I have those interviews. So that was kind of nice, kind of different. Bill W. was interviewed by Mike Wallace. And most people didn't, even archives didn't know who did the interview until I let them know that. But that's, yeah, some of that stuff is really cool for me, and it just kind of fueled that intense desire to know more. And that's, I think, a lot of alcoholics and, you know, are obsessive personalities. So I found myself, you know, kind of obsessing about some of this stuff, and it's like my wife's like, just take a break, would you? But so what I'd like to do is I'd like to share with you some history about AA that you don't always hear, and I'm going to blend that with history that's real common, okay? So if you'll kind of go on a tour with me, okay? And, you know, we've all, if you've studied any history, you know a little bit about the Washingtonians, okay? And the Washingtonians was an organization that started in the 1840s, and they were started by six men. Okay. And, you know, the idea was these guys just got this this non-drinking thing down, and they started telling other people about it, and it kind of caught on. And they would go and they'd bring wagons into these towns, and they would set up a podium, and they would start giving a lead, you know, and crowds would gather around, and within 2 years, 3 years, they had 100,000 members. Okay? And the organizations grew, but they didn't have traditions. Okay? So just as quickly as it grew, the organization died. Okay? It stopped. They allowed non-AA members to, or people who didn't have drinking problems to be in there. And then it got into politics and got into wet and dry movements. And there are all kinds of things that interfered with the growth and the stability of that organization. So it didn't make it. When Bill was writing the traditions for Alcoholics Anonymous, he used the experiences of not only the first few groups in AA, he used the experiences of the organization of the Washingtonians to try to make sure that we didn't do what they did, that AA didn't go the same direction by allowing all of these other issues that are non-related to get involved. There was a guy named Roland Hazard. And Roland came from a wealthy family. He was a bad drunk. And he had the means to go to Switzerland to try to get help. And he was under the care of a noted psychiatrist named Dr. Carl Jung. And Dr. Jung met with Roland, and they had spent time together, and he worked with him. And Roland had done pretty well with the therapy that he was able to receive at the time. And he was sober, and he thought he could make it, and things were going to be all right. And then it came tumbling down in the form of a drink. And he went back to Dr. Jung, and he said, "I don't know what I'm going to do. I can't stop." And Dr. Jung said, "I can't help you, Roland. I've done everything that I can. And short of you having a spiritual experience of some sort, there is no hope for you, and you're going to die." And he was with a wealthy family. And he traveled back to the United States hopeless. But in the back of his mind was this spiritual experience. How do I get that? And I picked up a tape a few years ago of Dr. Sam Shoemaker, who was very instrumental in the early days of AA, and became very close with Bill Wilson. And Dr. Shoemaker was sharing the Roland Hazard story. And this is the part that I had never heard. Roland got back to the United States. He had in his mind this spiritual experience, and he picked up a book called Varieties of Religious Experience, written by William James. That's the same book that Bill mentions that Abby brought to Bill in the hospital. Roland's reading this book, and in it there's a section on conversions. And while he's reading about conversions, there's one conversion in particular that strikes him. And it's a conversion of a guy named Samuel Hadley. Samuel Hadley was a horrible drunkard. And Samuel Hadley in 19, he had his conversion, and I think 1878 or 1879, around there. Well, Roland's reading about this guy, and if you read Varieties of Religious Experience, which is to me a really boring book, but there are some parts of it that are fascinating. Skip part of it and go to conversions and find the one on Samuel Hadley and read that. It really is great. He talks about that they'll find him at the bottom of the river. Okay, he's contemplating suicide. He can't stop drinking. He doesn't want to become a drunkard, and he knows that he is. And finally, he gets himself locked up in jail just so he can get sober. And then he goes to his brother's house. And he gets to his brother's house, and somehow he gets led to the local mission there in New York. And the mission there in New York was called the Water Street Mission at that time. And he goes into the Water Street Mission, and he hears the guy giving testimony that night. And it was the guy that ran the mission. And that guy's name was, give me a minute, Jerry McCauley. Okay? And Jerry McCauley, they nicknamed Jerry McCauley the Apostle to the Lost. Okay? The Apostle to the Drunkard. And Samuel Hadley goes in and he hears this guy talking about overcoming his problem with alcohol. And Hadley goes up front and he gets down on his knees and he offers his life up and he has a conversion. And he never drinks again and he spends the next 15 years of his life working with alcoholics in Skid Row, New York, at the Water Street Mission. And his conversion's in the book of Varieties of Religious Experience. And Roland reads this story, and it's one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, and he's touched by it. And he begins to have a spiritual experience of his own, just because he finds hope in someone else's story. So he seeks out a local mission in New York, and this is in the mid-1930s. And he comes upon the Oxford group, and it was missioned at the Calvary Church, and that was where Sam Shoemaker is. And he goes into the Oxford group mission there, and who's he greeted by when he gets to the door? Samuel Hadley's son, Henry Hadley, was working at the mission. Tell me God doesn't work in mysterious ways. So Roland is so moved by this. He has his spiritual conversion. Okay? His spiritual awakening. He stops drinking. He starts to live and learn the tenets and the principles of the Oxford group at that time. And he gets a couple of his friends, one named Shep Cornell and another named Seber Graves. And they go to see a guy that they know named Ebby Thatcher. And Ebby was a schoolmate of Bill W.'s. Well, Ebby was in trouble with the law. And the reason he was is because he drove his car through a lady's house, right? Drunk. So he's like in the lady's kitchen, okay? Instead of feeling remorse or ashamed at his actions, he rolls the window down and says, "Could I trouble you for a cup of coffee, ma'am?" She didn't approve of his behavior. So Abby was facing jail time, and Seber Graves' dad was the judge. And these three men, Seber and Roland and Shep, talked to him and said, could you release Ebby to our custody? Could you let us have a shot with this guy? We think we can help him. And he said, yeah, just get him out of town. So they got Ebby to the Oxford group. And Ebby started attending the meetings, and he got sober, and he was beginning to have a spiritual conversion of his own. And one of the things the Oxford group was teaching at the time was that you carry this message to someone else. Okay? The Oxford group was not an organization set up to help alcoholics. Okay? It was really set up for people who wanted life-changing experiences. Okay? It was really, I mean, the background was the guy that started the Oxford Group was a man named Frank Buchman. And he started it with the philosophy of getting back to first century Christianity. And that's what he wanted to do. And that was really the name that they used in the beginning. And then he was over in England. He had a group of students from Oxford. They were doing a mission work in, I think, in South Africa. That, as you can see, I don't bring notes because I'd never use them if I had them. But one of the reporters had said, "Well, who are these people over here? What are they doing?" And they said, "Oh, that's the Oxford Group." And that's how the Oxford Group got their name, okay? Because a reporter had inquired, and it was a group of students from Oxford that was there with Frank Buchman on mission work. So they had taken principles, okay? And the principles, the four absolutes that the Oxford Group used was absolute love, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity, love, unselfishness, purity. Come on, somebody else. Yeah. Honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. Okay. They had taken those principles from a book written by a minister named Robert Speer. And he wrote the book in 1909. And that book's called The Principles of Jesus. And in that book are the four absolutes. And that's where the Oxford Group got the absolutes. Well, they brought them into their organization and they started to try to live by this. Okay? Well, here Abby comes in and Roland's in there and Shep. And these guys are sober. You know, and Abby thinks, gosh, I know this guy here in New York. I'm gonna talk to him. And he goes and he calls Bill W. and he goes over and he meets with Bill. And, you know, the details of that meeting are in Bill's story, you know, at least the way that Bill wanted to present those details. Later, you know, some of the history that AA presents to us, we historians have been able to find out there's been some altercations to some of that, you know, some adjustments here. And I'm like, you know what, it's cool. People are now saying, you know, Dr. Bob's sobriety date was June 17th and not June 10th, you know. And to me, June 10th works, you know. I mean, it's worked for this many years. I don't need to change it. But I understand as a historian or a researcher, people do want to try to uncover as many facts and truths that they can about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, so Abby goes to see his friend Bill on a cold November evening. And he sits there while Bill drinks. And Bill looks at him, and Bill's touched by the magic of Abby because he knows from his heart and from his eyes that there's something different about Abby. You know? And Bill said, "What's gotten into you, my boy?" And Abby said, "Religion." And Bill kind of laughed it off and thought, rather than an alcoholic crackpot, now he's a religious crackpot. And to kind of humor him, Bill just looked at him and said, "Well, what brand?" And Abby said, "Well, Bill, I don't really know if you'd call it a brand. It's really not any particular denomination. It's kind of you choose your own conception of God." And Bill thought, "Well, that's an interesting theory." And I think that stayed in Bill's mind. And I'm sure that it did after Abby left. And Bill didn't just stop drinking, but you know, Abby had left, but Abby had left Bill with an impression made upon him, and you know, I think that's important for us alcoholics that have the opportunity to go on 12-step calls to realize that, you know, the magic doesn't always happen the day that we're there. You know, sometimes it takes, in my case, it took me 11 years to get one. You know, sometimes it takes time. Well, Bill was profoundly affected by Abby, and he did seek out the Oxford Group. And he went into a meeting in the Oxford Group, and he wanted to share with them his wisdom. He wasn't sober, but he felt like he had some wisdom to share. And they tried to stop him from going up and talking, and Abby said, "No, no, let him go." And they let him share. And within a couple of days after that, Bill had another brief sobriety, and then he went to play golf one day. And it was what we call Veterans Day now. And Lois found him the next day in the alley, kind of banged up and bloodied, and he had drank again. And Bill had some trouble sobering up that time, and finally in his story he tells it, he goes into Towns Hospital for the last time, and he's waving a bottle of beer, and he says to the doctor there, "I've got it. I've got it this time," because he's remembering Ebby. And the doctor says, "You sure do, my boy. Now go on up and sleep it off." And the doctor's talking to Lois about the fact that they're going to have Bill committed, because he had been there too many times. And there was nothing they could do medically for Bill. And while Bill's in the room, he cries out in desperation, "If there's a God, show himself." And the room lights up. And Bill has a profound spiritual experience in that room. And he feels a great wind. And he feels like he's on a mountaintop. And he's moved. And he has this spiritual experience. And he wants to tell the doctor about it. And he starts telling the doctor. And he says, "Maybe I'm having a hallucination. Maybe this didn't happen." And he goes through and he says, "Doctor, am I crazy? Am I losing it? Am I nuts?" And the doctor said, "Bill, I don't know. Something's happened to you. And whatever it is good. It's so much better than what you had just a short time ago." And Bill got sober. And Bill then, Ebby comes back to see him. And Bill says, "Ebby, what is this? What is this thing that we do?" And Ebby kind of outlines the program to him. And he says, "Bill, we got to admit that we're licked, you know. That we're done. We're licked. We gotta believe in a God of some sort. Okay? We have to do a confession. You know, a confession. And then we gotta do restitution. And then we gotta work with others." And these were what became the initial steps of Alcoholics Anonymous before AA had a name. See, AA went for a couple of years as a nameless society. But those were the initial steps that Bill learned from Ebby, and he began to do them while he was in the hospital. And he then got permission from the hospital to talk to the patients. Okay? Bill W. was the first person that I've been able to do research and find out that was granted permission to talk to patients, okay, about treatment for alcoholism in the United States. And he was doing it in the hospital, Towns Hospital, which was at that time the noted hospital in the U.S. for treatment of drugs and alcohol. Amazing that they gave this guy that opportunity. And Bill, with all the enthusiasm that a newcomer has, I mean, he's sober, you know. He's trying to sober people up, and he's grabbing people out, and he's bringing them to the Oxford group, and he's preaching to them, and he's trying to get them to have a conversion, and he's trying to get them to have that same spiritual experience that he had, because he knows that if they have that experience, that this obsession to drink will be removed from them, and they'll have what he has. So with intensity, he's out trying to help these alcoholics. Well, Lois is working at a department store. And they have no money. And it's right after the recession. And things are tough. Things are very tough. And Bill came from having a good, lucrative job to nothing, to living off his wife. And his alcoholism had brought him to that bottom, to where they were living in a house that was owned by the family of Lois on Clinton Street. And he's trying to help alcoholics, and nobody stands sober. And Bill's just getting depressed. He's doing everything that he can, and he feels like he needs to go to work, and he doesn't know what to do, and nobody stands sober. And finally, he says to his dear wife, "This isn't working. Nobody stands sober." And she says, "Ah, Bill, you are." See, in that miracle, Alcoholics Anonymous was born. See, Bill then went and talked to his doctor, Dr. Silkworth, at Towns Hospital. And he said, "I'm having no success as these people I'm working with. And I want to help them, Doc. They're dying." Dr. Silkworth says, Bill, you got to stop preaching to him. Bill, why don't you talk to him about the allergy and the obsession of alcohol? Has on the mind of an alcoholic, how the alcoholic's body is different than that of a non-alcoholic. And Bill had to go on a business trip to Akron. And, you know, you guys know the story. He met Dr. Bob. But he did because he was in the hotel at the Mayflower in Akron, Ohio. And the business deal fell apart and he had 10 bucks in his pocket. And what does an alcoholic do when a business deal falls apart and they're 6 months sober and they're in a strange city by themselves? He thinks, hey, I know what'll fix this. And he hears the music coming from the bar. And he sees the smoke in the bar and he can smell the odor. And he's thinking, that's my solution. I could just go in and have a couple drinks. I got 10 bucks in my pocket and I'll feel better at least for a little while. Besides that, his wife's working in a department store and he wasn't happy with that. And things weren't going real good. But he thought, man, I don't want to do that. And he's pacing the hallway there at the Akron, at the Mayflower. And down at one end of the hallway is a bar, and the other end is a church directory. And he sees that church directory, and he thinks, I need to talk to somebody. Lois was right. When I was trying to help an alcoholic, I was staying sober. I need to talk to somebody. And he reaches for the phone and he just pulls a name off of that list, and the name happened to be Dr. Walter Tunks. And Bill later in one of his talks said he thought the name was kind of funny, so he called it. He calls Dr. Tunks, and Dr. Tunks gives him a name about 10 people that he knows that are associated with the Oxford group. And he says, Bill, you can try these people. And he calls the names on that list. And the first 9 names were busy, going out of town, this or that was going on, whatever it was. But he came to that last name, and that name was Henrietta Cyberline. And he knew the family because of the business transaction that he'd been involved in. And he knew that family. He knew them by name. And he thought, well, I'll call. He didn't want to call, but I'll call. And he calls, and a sweet lady answers the phone. And she says, Bill, I don't have your problem. But I know someone who does. I don't know if I can arrange for you to meet with him. He's a local doctor here in town. But I'll try to see if I can arrange that. Let me call you back. And she calls Dr. Bob's house. And it's May 11th, 1935. It was the day before Mother's Day. And she calls and Ann Smith answers the phone. And she says, we'd love to come. But tomorrow's Mother's Day, and the doc brought me home a potted plant, and he's potted under the table. We can't come. He was passed out drunk. She said, we'll come tomorrow, Henrietta. So it was arranged for Bill and Dr. Bob to meet that afternoon on May the 12th, 1935, at the gatehouse of the Cyberline Estate in Akron, Ohio. And Smitty drove Ann and his dad over there. And Dr. Bob said, I'll give this guy 20 minutes. And he wasn't feeling real good. He says, I'll hear him out for 20 minutes. Now understand, Dr. Bob had been trying to quit drinking. He had been going to meetings of the Oxford group. He had been going to everywhere that he could to try to get sober with no success at all. And he was a medical man and he felt like he should know this. And here, this stockbroker that's got a cure for this alcoholism wants to meet with him. And he's just like you and me, man. He just says, all right, I'll give this bum 20 minutes. And he walks in, he sits down, and they move him into the library. And they sit in the library. 5.5 hours later, they come out. And Dr. Bob says, this is the first guy. This is the first guy. That knows how I feel. There's hope here. These two guys connect. Ann Smith, in her wisdom, invites Bill to move in with them for a little while. And she could kind of keep an eye on Dr. Bob, and he could kind of keep an eye on Bill. So Bill agrees. I mean, he's got no money. Where's he, you know, what's he going to do? So he lets Lois know, and he moves into Dr. Bob's house. And I shared with you this morning, the first guy, and for those of you that weren't here, I'm going to just repeat that story because it's just so important and to me and my sobriety. It changed my life, you know. Bill and Dr. Bob find a guy named Eddie R., and they recruit Eddie, and they bring him up to the bedroom, and they try to get Eddie sober. And Eddie climbs out the window and goes and gets drunk, and then Dr. Bob and Bill have to round him up and try it all over again. This happens a couple of times, and then Eddie chases Ann Smith around the house with a butcher knife. So they had no choice, you know, to have him committed because he was going to cause harm to someone. And, you know, as I shared this morning, you know, 15 years later, Eddie shows up at Dr. Bob's funeral sober. Smitty is moved by this because he says to Smitty, "Do you know who I am?" And Smitty says, "Yeah, you're Eddie." Now, Smitty told me that Eddie was sober 2.5 years, right? But Smitty didn't know the whole story. Because I didn't know this story until the last 60 days. I was always intrigued by what happened to Eddie, too. But what happened was, Eddie got sober, and he stayed sober until he died in, I think, late 60s. And he lived in Youngstown, Ohio. And he actually became employed by the National Council on Alcoholism, and he was very active. I found a letter from an antique, rare antique dealer. I deal in a little bit of those type of things. And this guy had a letter that was written by Bill Wilson to Eddie. Okay? But the guy said that it was to Father Ed Dowling. Okay? And I read the letter. They had sent me a copy so I could read it because I was trying to get it for somebody else. And I questioned that this just didn't make sense, that this letter was to Father Ed. So I contacted Archives in New York, and I said, "Do you have any correspondence between Bill W. and Eddie R.?" I want you to know, even though all these people are deceased, we respect the anonymity of people living and deceased in Alcoholics Anonymous. At least I do, and I believe that we should. I'd like to get that message to some of the people selling stuff on eBay that are putting pictures of people up there. But I contacted the General Service Office Archives, and I said, "Do you have any correspondence between this relationship of Bill and Eddie R.?" And they sent me back all kinds of neat stuff. Okay, to me, it's neat. But one was a letter written by Bill thanking Bill had was writing AA Comes of Age, the book, and he sent Eddie a copy of the transcript so that he could look it over, and if he saw anything that he wanted to have changed, because he was there in the beginning, that he'd let Bill know, and he did, and they had some correspondence about that, and Bill had said how proud he was of his comeback, and he had also said that he felt that it was providence that Eddie got sober on the eve of Dr. Bob's death. So he'd only been sober a couple of days when he saw Smitty. He got sober on the eve of Dr. Bob's death, and he never took another drink. And then the letter that I was getting for this guy, Bill had made copies and had it in the file. So they actually had the actual letter. So I knew that was a letter that Bill wrote to this Eddie. And that was really cool to have the opportunity to see that because of how profound that relationship of Eddie and Dr. Bob and Bill and Eddie getting sober later had on giving me hope and helping me to realize that AA wasn't built on success, that it really was a development as a result of failure. And that's why I felt like I belonged, because I knew I was a failure, you know. And I was, you know, and I think that's where, you know, of myself I'm nothing. My strength comes from a power greater than me. You know, I think that principle, this idea of of acceptance of a higher power has to be there, because without that, I can't be successful. I can't do that. I don't have the power to do that. So AA kind of started there in Akron with Bill and Dr. Bob and Eddie, you know, having a little bit of difficulty. And so they had to have Eddie institutionalized. So Dr. Bob and Bill didn't quit, though. They went, Dr. Bob went to Atlantic City. He had convinced Bill that he had been attending this medical convention in Atlantic City for years. And he had said he felt like he should go. And, you know, I think around then Bill's attitude was, well, Doc, you know, if you're not drinking, it doesn't matter where you're not drinking. And Bill got there, or Dr. Bob got there and decided to drink. And he ends up back in Akron drunk. Bill gets a phone call. Ann Smith gets a phone call. They go over. They pick Dr. Bob up. They try to get him straightened around. Dr. Bob's got a big surgery coming. And Bill and Dr. Bob were in the twin beds. And Dr. Bob had said to Bill, I'm going to do this thing, Bill. And Bill said, what's that? And he thought he was referring to the surgery. And what he meant was he was going to do this AA, this sobriety. It wasn't AA yet, but whatever this thing was that they were trying to do, Dr. Bob knew it was time and that he was going to do it and he could do it. He was able to go in and do that surgery successfully, and then he didn't return home. You know, the story is told now that he didn't go right home, and Bill and Dr. Bob's wife, Ann, were kind of concerned where Dr. Bob was, and he turned up about 6 hours later and found out that what he was doing is going around town making amends to people. So his very first day of sobriety, he spent making amends to people after he had done this surgery. You know, and that wasn't his first full day of sobriety, because Bill had given him a couple of bottles of beer before he went in to do the surgery. See, and people often ask me, you know, when should we start working on the steps? You know, when do I start doing this? Or, you know, you hear some people every now and then, you know, maybe if you did a step a year, you know, and I'm like, I don't know if that would work for me. But, you know, I believe that we should be moved by the Spirit and that we should get involved in these steps and do this program. Not in the sense of quickly, because, you know, for this alcoholic, and again, I'm only talking, when I talk about my story or any of this, it's just my interpretation or my opinion of what I've been able to learn. But I know that if you're in a position right now and you come into the program and you're new and you have a car, right, and you can drive two or three guys to meetings that don't have cars, then that's a service that you can be doing right now. Now, you might not be able to go on, you know, a 12-step call, you know, or handle some, even a 12-step call, I think you can with another person. But I guess what I'm saying is you may not even have read the book. You may not have done your 4-step yet. You know, you can still participate in working with others and helping people. And I think that we should use what we have to do that, you know, when we're coming in, engage the newcomer into activities as quickly as possible. And as I was saying earlier, help them to feel welcome and lift them up. And, you know, they said to me, kid, you're doing great, you know, 90 days. Boy, I've never seen anybody get this thing as quick as you are, John would say to me. I think, wait a minute, it took me 10 years, man. And it's like, but you start to feel good. And then, you know, when you get 6 months and, you know, you feel good. And then you get a year and they have the parades and, you know, all of that. And, yeah. Oh, they didn't do that for you. But I think that us working with a newcomer and realizing that if they want to, you know, I've had people, well, when's the right time to make an amends? Well, you know, I don't know that, you know, it's best to make an amends your first day, okay, depending on what it is. But I think that if the intention's there, you know, that there's ways to start to amend those situations right away, and we can do some things and get into action and find that hope and be of service and get started. And I think Dr. Bob was doing that right away. And he said to Bill, he says, you know, we need a drunk to work on, Bill. And Bill's like, okay, get us one. But Dr. Bob calls the nurse at Akron City Hospital, and she gets on the line, and he says, "Hey, I got a drunk here from New York, and he and myself have a cure for alcoholism, and is there a drunk there we can work on?" And the nurse politely says, "Did you try it on yourself?" And he said, "Oh, yes, you know." And she says, we've got a real doozy. He blackened the eyes of the nurse last night, and we got him strapped down. Will he do?" And Dr. Bob had given him a couple of requests, and then he and Bill went in the next day. And when they went in, and that's the picture of the man on the bed, you know, back there, Bill D., Dr. Bob, and Bill. And AA number 3, Akron City Hospital, Bill D. And that was June 26th, I think, of 1935. And Bill and Dr. Bob walked in there, and they saw this guy. And they didn't have an answer for him. All they had was hope. And they told them their story. They said, "This is what happened to us." And they found out that he was a deacon in his church, and they got him to talk a little bit. And he was free to talk to them. And he told them, "Guys, listen, this is my 6th time in a hospital this year. That was only in June." Okay? "I don't think this is going to work for me, but you boys are nice, you know. Well, I appreciate what you have to say." And, you know, they're alcoholics talking to another alcoholic. "You don't have to live that way anymore, Bill. You can get up. You can stand up. And you can stay up. We've got an answer." And he started to listen. And they said, "Would it be all right if we came back and to see you?" And he said, "Yeah, I believe I'd like that." And the next day he came back, and Bill and Dr. Bob walked in, and Bill D's in there with his wife, Henrietta. And he's pointing, there they are. There they are. Those are the guys. They know. Fetch my clothes." And he got dressed and he walked out. Never to take another drink. Because he found hope with one alcoholic bringing the message of hope to a dying, hopeless drunk. You know, Bill D's stories started in the second edition, AA number 3. And we can read that today. And if you read if you take the time to read some of the stories in the back of the big book, you'll be amazed at some of the things you hear. Okay? And there's comments like, you know, they came and gave him formaldehyde and knocked him out for a week. This wasn't Bill D. This is another one. But there was things like that going on in the beginning, in the early days of AA, as they were trying to figure this out. What do they do with people? Because some people would die when they'd stop drinking. They were dealing mostly with low bottom drunks that were, you know, that were of the hopeless variety, that really, you know, had struggled, like Bill D. And Bill was a deacon in his church. He was having some difficulty with the idea of having God in his life to deal with this not drinking thing. How are we doing on time? Anybody know? Joe? I got a couple hours left? Or? Right. Well, I'm only to the Mayflower Hotel. Well, anyway, in that story, Bill Dodson's talking about Bill Wilson being over having lunch. Okay? And he says, "My wife Henrietta is sitting across the table from Bill." And Bill says something like, "Henrietta, I am just so thankful to God for having cured me of this horrible disease that I just want to tell everybody about it." Okay? Now, I look at that and I think, I can see that, you know? I can feel that. When we begin to recover and we're released from the bondage of alcohol, okay, and that obsession has left, we're so grateful. We just want to tell everybody about it. If you don't feel that way today, bring that feeling into your consciousness, okay? Because when you're talking to a newcomer and you're so grateful for what you have, That message comes across, and they want that. That's where it says, if you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length. We don't want what someone has, and they say, how you doing? You say, oh, well, let me tell you, things are just bad. You know, they're just bad. My economy's bad. My wife is bad. It's all bad. You know. Oh, I want what he's got. Where do I get that? Come on, that's not the message of hope that they wanted us to give. We're free from an obsession that was killing us. That's electric. We have something that the doctors can't give you, religion can't give you. Nowhere else has it. You can't buy it for all the money in the world. But one alcoholic talking to an alcoholic, and they got it that quick. For fun and for free, we can do this. But we have to have that kind of enthusiasm and that kind of intensity. And no, why am I sober today? I'm only sober for one reason. And that's by the grace of God, so I can carry this message to somebody who isn't. That's why I'm here. That's why we're all here. That's our job. That's our responsibility. 1965, at the International, they introduced the Responsibility Pledge. I am responsible when anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA to be there, to always be there, and for that I am responsible. Man, that's the miracle. Yeah, that's why we're here. That's what we do. We carry the message. That is the purpose of every single AA meeting everywhere, regardless if it's at the conference this weekend in New York or at this meeting. Our purpose is to carry the message to the next guy. That's what we do. They learned that early on. Recently, in some of the archives that I've picked up, I came across a letter that was written by a lady who was from Colorado City, Texas, who was fairly well-to-do. And she was a pre-Al-Anon, back in the pioneering days. And she had enough money to travel around to the conferences. So she'd go to Toronto. There was a strong wives group in Toronto of Al-Anon. And she'd go up to Montreal. And she was in Toronto at a meeting. And she met a lady there. Bill D was on the program speaking at that conference, and his wife, Henrietta, was with him. And this lady, his name was Myrtle. And Myrtle was sitting next to this lady at a meeting and found out that it was the wife of Bill D. So they, after the meeting, instead of going to lunch, they just grabbed a couple of chairs and went over in the corner and started visiting. Well, Myrtle was one of these, like, investigative reporters, okay? I mean, I would have loved this lady. I really would have. Because, like, she, all of the records, she's just written so much, okay? And she's writing about this meeting with Henrietta Dodson. And she says, Henrietta, tell me about when Bill came to see you. Bill and Dr. Bob came to see you and the first time that you met. And she tells about that. And then she says, you know, Bill came over to the house. And I explained to him that I was a good Christian lady without sin. And Bill said, oh. Now, and this is after she explained that her husband was running down the halls of the hospital naked. And that she hit him over the head with something in the yard when he came home drunk one day. Okay. Some of the stories, you know, they're really kind of comical. Boy, can I identify, you know. That's why they say don't compare but identify, you know. Because if we hear enough of this, we will. We'll identify. It'll hit us. We'll connect. Well, Bill said, don't you think that your attitudes and actions and resentments toward your husband, how he's treated you and your son, our sins? And she said, well, I guess that they are. And he said, let's get down on our knees and ask God to remove these from you. And she said, we got on our knees with Ann Smith and Bill. And they knelt down and they offered up these sins. And she said, nothing profound happened. But later that night, she woke up in the middle of the night. And she just had this feeling that she knew that her husband would never drink again.
to be in a position, which we all are, to learn about what these folks did so that we could have this meeting today, so that we could be sober, to know. You know, I hear people say, you know, Bill wasn't a real spiritual guy. He did this and he did that. The people that are saying that just don't know the truth. You know, the truth is Bill had a profound spiritual experience. He was a human being just like us. And he did have difficulties in his life. And he did suffer from depression. But he always wanted to help that next suffering alcoholic. He was so concerned about us that he did so many things to try to put together programs and things that would help us today. That's where the traditions came from. You know, the traditions were first published in April of in the Grapevine. I believe it was April 1946. And when they were published, people rebelled against it. You know, some people didn't like it. No, that's happening. And over the next couple of years, they debated it, and there was things happening. And then Bill wrote the short form, and they introduced it in Cleveland, and they were accepted. But Bill knew that we needed these traditions so that AA would protect itself from AA. That AA would protect itself from the power-hungry people and money and prestige and all of that. That we would be able to do that. Since 1951... there have been 543 organizations granted permission from the World Service Office in New York to use the 12 steps and 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have to tell you, I don't know how many of those groups are in existence today, but I will tell you that the principles contained in the 12 steps have had a global impact on the family. Global impact on families all over, regardless of what the illness is. And yet there's still people who have never heard of AA and never heard of the 12 steps. There's still people dying of all these diseases out there and suffering hopeless conditions, not knowing that there's any help for them. And I think Bill saw that vision, and he didn't want AA to be all things to all people. He knew that we couldn't, and that's why we have the third tradition. But he certainly wanted them to have the opportunity of using the tools that were in AA, and if they came up with something better, he was fine with that too. But he wanted that message of hope to be carried out so that other people could benefit from it. And I'm grateful today that we have those groups. Yeah, and then you'll hear people talk about statistics and numbers, and they'll tell you, you know, AA is losing membership. I hear that all the time. I'm not so sure that I agree with it. In 1941, when the Jack Alexander article came out in the Saturday Evening Post, they said that membership went from 2,000 to 8,000. The history now shows that, well, it actually went to about 3,500. It didn't hit 8,000 for a couple more years, but it really was growing, and there was a lot of things happening. Okay? When Dr. Bob died in 1950, AA was still under 100,000 members. AA has passed 2 million members, whether it's, you know, 1.976 million or now or 2.1 million. I don't know that that's nearly as important as the fact that in most communities today, you've got N-A, O-A, C-A, G-A, S-A, Al-Anon, Al-Ateen, Al-Atat, everything. Okay? We have opportunities for people to recover. Okay? And I think that's what's important for us to look at. Okay? As we see the blessings of the miracle of the 12-step movement. And that's really what we have. Well, I'm getting kind of tired. It's finally gotten warm in here. There's so much about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd like to share with you. I don't have time to do that. It would take several books. I was just blessed. I hope that you feel touched to go out and pick up some information. You know, maybe grab some of the CDs of the early guys. And listen to some of the things and read the stories in the back of the book. Read AA Comes of Age and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Oh, that lady I told you about, Ruth G., that I met in Adrian, Michigan. When I was reading Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, I see all this stuff in there, and it's quoted by Ruth, and I'm like, oh, I know her. God put these people in my life. My sponsor said to me, because he got to know Bill D.A. number 3, and he said, Mike, he said, I was up in the area there doing some work, and I had the privilege of meeting Bill D., and I went to Bill and I said, Bill, what's this AA deal all about? And he said, John, did you ever stop to think of what your life is made of? And John was a former attorney, as was Bill. And John said, no, I guess I've been kind of busy. And then John followed up and saying, I could step on a chew of gum and tell you what flavor it was because of the holes in his shoes. And he looked at Bill and he said, no. And Bill said, John, your life and mine are made up of 4 things. Thoughts, actions, habits, and character. Now you ask me what this AA deal is all about. In this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship of the Second Chance, we can show you how you can learn to think like a useful and a decent person. From that, you'll have the actions of a useful and a decent person. From those actions, you'll develop the habits of a useful and a decent person, and once more, you can be restored to the life of a useful and a decent person. And going back to AA number 3 and looking at my life today, a couple of years ago, my mother-in-law came by the house, and she said, would you consider having Grandma move in with you? Grandma was 97, and she was a patient at the local nursing home. And I was working at home, and I said, well, yeah, I think that'd be a good idea. So they moved Grandma in. She was a total care patient. This is my wife's grandmother. She was a total care patient. That meant I had to lift her out of bed, do everything, feed her. You know. She did feed herself a little bit, but you know, I had to give her assistance for everything. And I was able to do that. I'll tell you, the first night that they brought her in, you know, they got the hospital bed set up, and she's in this chair, and you know, I have to do some things I'm uncomfortable with, and I didn't know what to do. I went into my room, I closed the door, I got down on my knees, and I just what I do when I'm sponsoring a new person. I said, God, I don't know what to do here, and I can't do it, but I know with you all things are possible, so I need you to do this for me. And from that day to the day that she passed away, I never had a problem dealing with her. And when she passed on, her family came to me and told me how happy they were for everything I did for her, to make her life and bring joy to her life for that last year. And of course, I was moved by that. But with all the sincerity as I possibly could have, I just was able to look at them and said, you'll never know what she did for me. See, because the opportunity to serve gives us the blessings. We're the ones that are blessed because of the service that we do. And if you're missing that part of the triangle, right? We have recovery, we have unity, and we have service. If you're missing that part, stick your hand out and tell someone you're glad they're here. Give them a hug. Make them feel welcome. Thank you.